All of a sudden, my book disappeared from Amazon.com. It was removed. For 7 days, you couldn't buy this book. This is the Lulu version of it, Kamala Harris and the Future of America. You couldn't buy it. My book was pulled.
Caleb Maupin is a journalist, political analyst, and founder of the Center for Political Innovation. He's also the author of Kamala Harris and the Future of America, an essay in three parts, which we'll be discussing today. Welcome, Caleb, and thank you for joining us today.
Sure. Glad to be here with you.
Your book came out a little over 4 years ago. I believe August was the published date. And one of the major themes of your book is that Joe Biden did not want Kamala Harris as his VP, and that she was essentially inserted into his campaign against his wishes, with the expectation, as you even mentioned in this book, again, reported over 4 years ago, that he was senile, and you use that word, and that Harris's camp anticipated that Harris would eventually take over at some point during those 4 years. Now we kind of fast forward to almost present day, where Biden basically gets pushed out after, you know, shortly after the debate with Trump, where everyone saw that he, of course, was senile and had dementia. And then fast forward to basically present day, where Kamala Harris is now the Democratic presidential nominee, even though she's really never gone through any of the proper traditional channels to even be in this position. So I would say your book was fairly accurate, and you really had some amazing foresight there. Would you say that's accurate?
Sure. I wrote the book. It was published in August of 2020, just as Kamala Harris was named the VP running mate of Joe Biden. And in the book, I documented how it's very clear that Joe Biden tried to not have her be his VP. He named a date where he would be picking his VP, and that date arrived, and there was no VP. And throughout the summer, he had said it would be a woman of color after there was a reaction to his remarks about "you ain't black" and all that. The media was saying, oh, he needs to pick a woman of color. He said it would be a woman of color. And then the media started saying, well, it had to be Kamala Harris. And the Biden camp kept saying, no, we haven't made a decision yet. Karen Bass, who's now the mayor of Los Angeles, her name was floated. She was in the House of Representatives. Susan Rice, her name was floated. And it got to be that date that Joe Biden had named, and there was still no name of a VP nominee. Then they published the Democratic National Convention schedule, and Kamala Harris was listed on the schedule separate from the VP nominee. And everyone in the media was like, whoa, it's not going to be Kamala Harris. And then Kamala Harris unfollowed Joe Biden on Twitter very publicly. And everyone gasped and said, oh, wow, it looks like there's some disagreements. And then 6 hours after that, Joe Biden said, okay, it's Kamala, and announced Kamala Harris. There was a really big effort on the part of Joe Biden not to pick Kamala Harris as his VP. And Trump alluded to that in the recent debate. He said, I'll let you in on a little secret. He hates her, he hates her. He can't stand her. That's pretty true. And if you look at what's come out since she's taken the vice presidency, you know, her office is toxic. She cannot keep staff members. Kamala Harris is somebody with a very unique background. And I wrote this book 4 years ago, before she had taken office as VP. Everything I wrote in the book, everything that I observed about her personality, about her background, has been very well confirmed. And then on the date that she received the nomination, you know, on Sunday, July 21st, Joe Biden announced he wasn't going to run. And then on, you know, Monday, July 22nd, they announced that basically started treating Kamala Harris as the presumptive nominee. And all of a sudden, my book disappeared from Amazon.com, and it was removed. And for 7 days, you couldn't buy this book. This is the Lulu version of it, Kamala Harris and the Future of America. You couldn't buy it. And my book was pulled. And so there was a lot of outrage. Max Blumenthal spoke up. Jimmy Dore spoke up. Candace Taylor spoke up. InfoWars was talking about it. Everyone was like, why did they pull this book? But it accompanied a whole widespread campaign of censorship. They fixed the YouTube and the Google search algorithms that day to obliterate the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. They were doing everything they could to amp up pro-Kamala messages and suppress anything critical about her. You couldn't find articles that had been written exposing her career as a prosecutor and what she had done. So amid a widespread full frontal boosting of Kamala by the ultra tech monopolies like Facebook and Google and Twitter, my book was removed from Amazon. They didn't restore it for 7 days. It took them 7 days to restore it back on Amazon. But that generated a huge amount of outrage. And I was on Jimmy Dore. I was on Kim Iverson. I was on InfoWars. I was on George Galloway's show in Britain, the mother of all talk shows. And I was talking about the contents of my book. And if anything, it was the Streisand effect, where you draw attention to something, because this said to a lot of people, we need to know what's in Caleb's book. So it's an interesting controversy. It makes me wonder what lists I'm on if she does indeed win the presidency, what lists I might be on. We understand that the next day after my book was pulled, Tulsi Gabbard was put on the Quiet Skies terrorism watch list. Now, that's interesting because my book explicitly talks about Tulsi Gabbard in chapter 3. I talk about why Tulsi Gabbard used her limited time on the debate stage to go after Kamala Harris and who Tulsi Gabbard is tied to in the Pentagon and the rivalry within the Obama administration and between the Pentagon apparatus and the anti-terrorism apparatus of the American government versus the regime change, color revolution entities that come out of Silicon Valley who have groomed Kamala Harris. And I think the Quiet Skies terrorism label being put on Tulsi Gabbard and my book being removed, it fits an overall thing. And we see now with the, you know, the prosecution of Donald Trump at to keep him from being in office, hundreds of January 6th defendants being locked up and given ridiculous sentences, the targeting of the Uhuru 3 that has been taking place in federal court in Florida. All of this fits, you know, that Kamala Harris is taking us in a very, very dangerous direction. We're being told that we should vote for her because Donald Trump might weaponize the Department of Justice against his enemies. Kamala Harris is already doing that, and she's trying to use the power of the Department of Justice to suppress those who disagree with her and suppress voices like mine that have criticized her. So, it's been an interesting journey. I wrote this book 4 years ago, had no idea that it would blow up the way it did, but I'm glad people are reading it, and I'm glad people are gaining the insights from it.
You basically asked the question in the book, where did Kamala Harris come from? And again, you published this book in August of 2020, and now we're in, September of 2024. I don't really think any more information about where Kamala Harris has come from has actually come to light. You know, Obama, like everyone knew that Obama's father and that he spent his, you know, part of his childhood in Indonesia, and everyone knew everything about Obama. But it seems like with Harris, even to this day, not much is known about her. And, right. and why is that as well?
Right. Well, I wrote this book because I worked with somebody. There was somebody I worked with who's an academic who had worked with Kamala Harris's father, Donald Harris, had worked with him in an academic capacity. I knew that Kamala Harris's father was, at least at one point, a very active communist and an outspoken Marxist economist who taught at Stanford University. And that fascinated me. I thought, how can Kamala Harris? I looked over her career as a prosecutor and what she did. And so that led me to start doing research on the background of Kamala Harris and digging. And everything that I put out in the book, it all matches. You know, I mean, I don't have any unique special info or whatever. I just have information that's publicly available, but I put together a narrative of who she is. The first chapter of the book, the first essay is, where did Kamala Harris come from? Kamala Harris is a product of the Berkeley New Left. You know, she grew up in Berkeley, California, Oakland, California, the Bay Area. Her parents were protesters. They met at civil rights and anti-Vietnam War protests. They were part of the free speech movement at University of California, Berkeley. They were most likely members or close to some communist organization. I'm sure there's an FBI file somewhere that would say that, because especially in the early 60s, communist groups were monitored very closely by the FBI. Were they in the Progressive Labor Party, the Socialist Workers Party, the Communist Party? They were in one of these groups or around one of these groups. Donald Harris was teaching classes on Marxist economics and, you know, considered himself from that tradition. And they were in the Bay Area. They were going to lots of protests. Kamala Harris, you know, in her autobiography, she says that when her parents divorced, the only thing they fought over was the books. However, Donald Harris, her father, begs to differ. And he talks about, he came forward when she was running for president in 2020 to put forward an essay that he wrote called Reflections of a Jamaican Father, where he talks about how they fought about over something else, which was custody, and how there was a pretty ugly custody battle in which he was denied custody. And he denounced Kamala Harris during her 2020 presidential campaign. And he denounced her because she went on The Breakfast Club, which is an African-American radio program. And they asked her if she'd ever smoked marijuana. And I mean, this was just a crazy moment in Kamala Harris's career, because they asked her, have you ever smoked marijuana? And she said, oh, yeah, when she was in college, she smoked weed. And they asked her, and she listened to music while she smoked weed. And they asked her, what music did you listen to while you smoked weed? And she said, oh, had to be Snoop. Well, people looked at the timeline and, you know, Snoop Dogg had not released any albums yet at the time that she was in college. So that was a little bit odd. So she was probably not telling the truth there. But then afterwards, she said, half my family's from Jamaica. What do you think? And that was the line that her father did not appreciate. And he came forward and he said that his entire Jamaican family wants to distance themselves from this travesty of identity politics, and that the stereotype of Jamaicans as pot smokers, as joy seekers, as lazy, he really didn't appreciate. If you read her father's essay, Reflections of a Jamaican Father, you'll learn why that is, because that stereotype was used to prevent him from being able to raise his daughters, his two daughters, that they played up. He says that the courts saw him as a Negro from the islands who might eat his daughters for breakfast. And he resented that. Now, in the essay, I also talk about how Kamala Harris talks about attending a Black cultural center when she was a child. Her mother took her to a Black cultural center and she would attend, you know, classes there. She was involved in, like, you know, cultural performances there. And this was called Rainbow Sign. And it was in the Bay Area in the 1970s. It was a Black cultural center that was set up by James Baldwin. And if you look at Rainbow Sign Cultural Center in the Bay Area, it was pretty clear. So Oakland, California was the center of the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers were, you know, this communist Black liberation organization that was very popular in the 1970s. James Baldwin was a Black writer and intellectual who'd been promoted by the CIA. The CIA had a magazine called Paris Review, and they were promoting James Baldwin as an alternative to the communist wing of the Black movement. And James Baldwin apparently set up this cultural center, Rainbow Sign, that was apparently, it looks like it was kind of set up by the CIA and pro-U.S. intelligence wing of the Black radical movement as an alternative to the Black Panthers. And Kamala Harris attended events there. She talks about going to Rainbow Sign, and it appears that she spent her childhood, going to this cultural center that was kind of set up by American intelligence to counter the Black Panthers, to counter more pro-communist elements within the Black radical movement. So that's very interesting. And I talk about the New Left, where the New Left came from, how the New Left was largely created by the American government as an alternative to the existing communist groups, and how McCarthyism had started out as just kind of a crackdown on communism, but it had turned into a vehicle for people like the John Birch Society and others to call out some of the richest and most powerful Americans, the Rockefellers and the United Nations and such. And so McCarthyism was clamped down on, and the New Left was kind of a new creation that was, you know, existed to combat McCarthyism. And it was funded by our tax dollars. CIA money was being pushed into the Paris Review, Partisan Review magazine, the work of Jackson Pollock, experimental music, all kinds of things were being funded by the CIA as kind of a weird psychological operation to oppose communism. And drugs were being distributed. And the Bay Area, where she grew up, was ground zero. I mean, the center of Project MK Ultra, which was a program where the CIA was distributing hallucinogens and LSD all over college campuses. But one of the main focuses was the Bay Area. They had Operation Midnight Climax, where they were just dropping drugs in people's drinks and restaurants of random people just to see what would happen. So, you know, the Bay Area in California was a center of radicalism. That's where Kamala Harris grew up. Her father was definitely an active Marxist and communist. Her mother was also, and they were involved in protests. There was an ugly divorce and a custody battle. And out of that, we get Kamala Harris. And that's a story that's not being told in the media. And it's worth looking into.
There's basically two books that have been kind of, say, negative towards Kamala Harris. Your book. And then there's another book called Amateur Hour. And yeah. I've read, in preparation for this podcast, I read Amateur Hour as well. And he discusses basically the start of her career was she was in her 20s, essentially dating a guy in his 60s named Willie Brown, who is the, you know, a speaker of the California State Assembly and went on to become mayor of San Francisco. And he was married, but he was estranged from his wife. But I think they were together for about a year. But it seems like every single connection and all of her jobs, I mean, she got these like plum jobs where she was on some board that met like a few times, you know, a few times a year, whatever, for like $90,000 a year, which in the 90s, which today is equivalent to a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. And then just ended up making all these connections. How instrumental was Willie Brown to Kamala Harris's career?
Well, isn't it interesting that there's only two books critical of Kamala Harris? I mean, this is a woman who's running for president. And when Barack Obama was running for president, there were like a million books about Barack Obama. And, there's a million books about Donald Trump. But there's only two books that have ever been published criticizing and looking into Kamala Harris's background with a critical eye. My book and the other book, The Amateur Hour. And that's it. Now, in the Amateur Hour book, they point out that Willie Brown, who went on to become mayor of San Francisco, who was just a notorious politician in the Bay Area, African-American lawyer who was notoriously tied up with organized crime. He was a pimp lawyer. And the way his career took off is the word got out on the street that if you were a pimp or a prostitute and you were arrested, have Willie Brown represent you, and the judge would throw out the charges. Willie had some connections. He knew some judges, he knew some people, and if you were a pimp or a prostitute, he could get you off. Now, that right there speaks to something that has hung over the Democratic Party for a long time, which is the legacy of corrupt urban political machines, right? The Democrats have always been the party of Tammany Hall in New York, of the Rizzo machine in Philadelphia, of Mayor Daley and the Daley machine in Chicago. And that as much as the Republican Party can sometimes have views that are out of the mainstream of Americans, they're much more sincere. Whereas the Democratic Party has always been the party of notoriously corrupt urban political machines that people associate with bribery and all kinds of nepotism, et cetera. And Willie Brown, he was this rising politician in San Francisco. And Kamala Harris was his arm candy that he would take to public events. She was this beautiful young woman who would, you know, be seen with him at clubs and such. And he was married, but, you know, estranged from his wife. And she was his beautiful young girlfriend. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure people have heard about the nicknames and other things that Kamala Harris got. But the main thing is that Kamala Harris was rising in California politics at a time that incarceration was rising. This is when Hillary Clinton was talking about super predators. This is when Joe Biden's crime bill was passed. And California in particular had a rising rate of incarceration. They had the three strikes law. If you get convicted of a third felony, no matter what it is, you get 25 years automatically. And there was just mass rise in the number of people doing prison time in California. Kamala Harris was a prosecutor who helped make it happen. And as a woman who looks like an African-American woman, her background is she's half Jamaican, she's half Indian. But as someone who looks like an African-American woman, juries were more likely to trust her when it came to convicting a black man. And, you know, she had very, very little qualms about destroying people's lives. And I mean, videos have come out of her joking about locking up parents for truancy. And there's a mother that's come forward, a mother of a special needs disabled child who ended up in handcuffs and arrested because of Kamala Harris's policy of arresting parents because their kids aren't in school. Now, obviously, if kids aren't getting to school, that's a problem. And if parents are being neglectful and not getting their kids to school, something needs to be done about it. But when you have low income families that are struggling, putting the parents in jail and then having the kids go into the foster system is really not a great way of dealing with it. But if you watch that clip where Kamala Harris talks about it, she's giggling about it and she starts saying, well, I wouldn't be anywhere if it wasn't for my education. It's all about her, right? It's some kind of weird revenge fantasy. And Kamala Harris talks about her childhood more than any other politician that we have seen. I mean, you know, she had a T-shirt. That little girl was me was the big line that she shouted at Joe Biden. She has T-shirts with 10-year-old Kamala Harris on them. And, you know, it's her childhood, you know, the world was unfair to her, we are told, for a number of different reasons. I guess she experienced racism. There were neighbors who couldn't play with her because they thought she was an African-American person. She and her sister were. There were a variety of things that happened. She blames Donald Harris for whatever it is, right? She sees her childhood self as a victim, and she sees Donald Harris as the one responsible. And that's been made pretty clear over the course of the past 4 years. I mean, he's She's been vice president for 4 years, and he has not once visited the White House. He did not attend her inauguration. He did, you know, denounced her campaign, and that's that. Interestingly, he actually owns a house in Washington, D.C., not far from the White House, but he still has had no interactions with her. She blames Donald Harris for something that went on in her childhood. We don't exactly know what. Her mother is a saint. Her mother can do no wrong. She speaks of her mother as this sainted figure. We also know that Kamala Harris speaks very little about the time she spent as a teen living in Quebec, that she graduated from high school back in Oakland. She spent her pre-adolescence, her childhood in Oakland, but her teen years were spent in Quebec in Canada. And there's just a huge blank spot over that. She never discusses anything that went on. I've heard rumors of different things that may have happened to her when she was at high school in Quebec. I can't confirm them because no one really knows. But it's weird that, you know, she lived in another country for the bulk of her high school career and has nothing to say about it. That's pretty odd. You know, there's one anecdote in her autobiography, The Truths We Hold, where she talks about her high school graduation, how her father attended. And because her father was there, she believed her mother wouldn't come. And so that points to a pretty ugly divorce, right? If her mother wouldn't come to her high school graduation just because her father was there, and how overjoyed she was that her mother actually showed up at her high school graduation, even though her father was in the audience. Now, that indicates it was anything but a pleasant divorce. That indicates some very, very intense, hard feelings. She had that kind of anxiety. Kamala Harris is not really telling us the whole story. She does have a huge amount of resentment. She is estranged from her father, and her father has denounced her. And that's a story people need to look into. And if you look at Kamala Harris as the vicious, vengeful prosecutor that she is, and I'm sure you'll ask me about that in a little bit, and her ability to just destroy other people's lives and giggle about it and have, you know, indifference to other people's suffering and engage in all kinds of prosecutorial misconduct that has really serious ramifications for people's lives. If you look into that, at that point, you will understand that it is driven by feelings of victimhood and rage at her own father. And that's something that needs to be looked into. It's a story that needs to be told.
We started this podcast talking about how you mentioned she was basically inserted into the Biden campaign against Biden's wishes. And then you mentioned about, you know, ultimately who's backing her. And you mentioned it's the same people that backed Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, well, there was a meeting in the Hamptons that took place that was reported on in the press in New York City, page6.com and some other websites. And it was in the Hamptons in Long Island. David Geffen, the musician who's a big supporter of Hillary Clinton, along with a number of other financial backers of Hillary Clinton, they gathered. And it was decided that Hillary Clinton just couldn't run for president in 2020, that she could not have another presidential campaign. And so they picked Kamala Harris as who they would put their money behind. And the Hillary Clinton backers made a very strategic decision to put their money behind Kamala Harris. And that's how she became a candidate in 2020. And then during that campaign, you'll notice it was Tulsi Gabbard who confronted her on the debate stage about her record as a prosecutor, about the fact that Kevin Cooper was hours away from getting the death penalty, and the governor of California wanted DNA evidence to make sure he was actually guilty of the crime, and her office tried to block that. That her office argued against releasing people from prison. People would be up for release, and her office would argue against it, not because of anything the person had done or anything about the person, you know, being, you know, reformed or having shown remorse or whatever, but because they needed to use the person's cheap labor. And this is, you know, in California in particular, you know, firefighters, right? That's a good paying job to be a firefighter. And firefighters, they work very hard, they're trained and all of that. And the state of California doesn't want to have to pay pensions and decent wages and salaries to firefighters. So they have prisoners be firefighters for free. And they get paid like 10 cents a day to be firefighters. And that's a cheap labor pool. And that saves them having to hire law-abiding citizens to be firefighters. And there's a number of other jobs in the state of California that are done by prisoners who work for 10 cents, 20 cents a day, rather than hiring law-abiding citizens and paying them decent wages and benefits to do it. And Kamala Harris's office would argue that people needed to stay locked up just so they could have the labor pool. They could have the labor pool to keep them locked up. I mean, how can any ethical person make that argument? I mean, that's just absolutely reprehensible. There was a drug lab scandal where there was a drug lab that was turning over false positive results. People would be on trial for committing some crime. They'd take a drug test, and the drug test would come back positive that they'd used drugs. when they hadn't used them. And Kamala Harris tried to cover this up, and for a long time covered this up, prevented the defense lawyers from getting this information. There were almost 1,000 people who ultimately had their sentences and convictions overturned after it was revealed that she had covered up that this drug lab was turning over false positive results. That's a pretty serious thing. And you look at all of this, she has no qualms about hurting other people if it will make her career advance, right? This is not an ethical person. Reason Magazine, who I cite in my book, has done great research showing what a vicious prosecutor she was, quoting judges in California, calling out her office for what they did. This is very, very disturbing. But yet, this is who Hillary Clinton's backers wanted. And in the book, I make the case, especially in the third chapter, that when Hillary Clinton ran the State Department, we saw the Arab Spring, we saw the destabilization of Syria and Libya, and Silicon Valley was involved, and that there was an effort to kind of spread chaos and spread revolution around the world for geopolitical ends. And that is who Kamala Harris is associated with. She's associated with the same people that brought us Samantha Power. She's associated with, you know, the George Soros has been a big backer of Kamala Harris for a long time. And that the regime change, color revolution, instability apparatus, that's who has been backing Kamala Harris. And that there's a fear in the Pentagon, Tulsi Gabbard is an active duty U.S. military person, of what the results could be of another Arab Spring. Because the Arab Spring that took place when Hillary Clinton was running the U.S. State Department, it brought us ISIS. It brought us all kinds of refugees fleeing Middle Eastern countries. It brought us a huge rise in Islamic terrorist organizations and extremist groups. And that Tulsi Gabbard, as somebody who has spent her life trying to fight terrorist groups, she doesn't want there to be another Arab Spring. And she also, kind of like Michael Flynn, another prominent Pentagon guy, she also thinks that the Russians, because the Russians have been fighting Islamic terrorists for a long time, since the war in Afghanistan, the Chechen separatist groups, the Russians could be useful allies. They are good at tracking these Islamic terrorist groups, and they can be useful allies. So rather than antagonizing the Russians, help get information and support from the Russians so that we don't have more ISIS terrorist attacks. And I think that is the position of Tulsi Gabbard. That's why she's such a big supporter of Israel. She views Hamas and the Palestinians as Islamic terrorists, and she doesn't want another Arab Spring that would result in more Islamic terrorism. And there's a lot of fear on the part of many people within the FBI, within the Pentagon and other places, that if the Hillary Clinton State Department, the regime change color revolution wing, if they get into the White House, the results will be chaos around the world and we'll all be a lot less safe. And there's a divide among the American government apparatus about this question. And that's the case that I make in the book. And it's very interesting that the day after this book was banned, Tulsi Gabbard was placed on the Quiet Skies terrorism watch list by the American government. So there are divisions among our elite and among the intelligence apparatus, no doubt.
We talked about where did, you know, Kamala Harris come from. There's not a whole lot of information on that, but there's also not a whole lot of information about what actually her policies are. And then, like we just mentioned, we had this debate between Trump and Harris and didn't really gather what her policies would even be in that debate. Maybe the only thing that they talked about was abortion in terms of her policies. But it seems like at this juncture, we still don't know what her policies are. We've heard something that maybe she's going to tax unrealized gains. Do we have an idea what her presidency would actually look like?
I mean, I think one thing we will see is exactly what she's accusing Trump of, which is political retaliation against her opponents, because they're already doing that. The other thing is that degrowth, reducing consumption, kind of transitioning the USA to a more, quote unquote, post-industrial economy, that is going to be a big part of a Kamala Harris presidency as well, right? You know, right now, America's roads and bridges are crumbling while all of our money goes to Ukraine to, you know, wage a proxy conflict with Russia. She wants to hang her hat on that. She is adamant that that is what she wants to, you know, she was proud of that. She wants to continue that. The majority of the American people don't want that, but that's what she's all about. And then, you know, you can look at some of the policies, the Green New Deal, which would be just getting rid of the fossil fuel apparatus of the United States, replacing it with windmills and solar panels. And that's one thing that Trump said during the recent debate. He said, look at her policies. There's nothing there. It's just like a couple sentences. It's run, spot, run, I think is what Donald Trump said. That's very accurate. You know, there's very, very little. She's making some nice sounding economic promises now, but why doesn't she do it? Well, we've seen, you know, Biden said a lot of great things in his speech that he gave when his first joint session of Congress, his first State of the Union. It wasn't a State of the Union technically, but he didn't do any of them. He didn't rebuild the infrastructure of the United States. He didn't provide the jobs. He didn't pass the PRO Act to protect organized labor and support labor unions. And we didn't see any of it. We just saw 4 years of sending weapons overseas and allowing the United States to crumble internally while targeting MAGA people, targeting the Trump movement, and endlessly talking about January 6th as if it was the most important event in American history, saying it was worse than 9/11, all kinds of crazy things like that. And I think that's what we'll expect under Kamala Harris. We can expect a more vengeful Department of Justice. We can expect more degrowth and more escalation of international tensions.
You mentioned Reason Magazine, and you know Reason Magazine has done quite a bit of pieces on censorship, and we just recently had the founder of Backpage, which is similar to Craigslist, get sentenced to 5 years in prison for basically like, you know, the people were listing like, oh, you have escort services or stripper services, which is all legal, but then, right, you know, people kind of offline are bartering other extracurricular services, so to speak. What does it have to do with the actual, that could happen on any platform, but then you're going after the platform. If that's the case, what if someone propositioned someone in an Uber or whatever? I mean, like, you're really kind of opening the floodgates there. We've recently seen Brazil crack down on censorship on Twitter or X. But I mean, Kamala Harris is, you know, has mentioned repeatedly that she wants to go after these tech companies on censorship. And as someone, you know, I think you've been canceled, and I say canceled in air quotes because obviously you're still here. But I mean, I've had strikes in my YouTube account, and I've had many videos taken down, fairly benign videos. My fiance got taken down for a video a couple of years ago talking about how her mother was offended by the term birthing person instead of mother. But if she is going to be the president coming up, are we going to see even more censorship than the censorship we already have?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, yes, that is a platform of hers, you know, fighting quote unquote disinformation or misinformation. And she has talked about, you know, tech monopolies need to be censoring and silencing people. And then Tim Walz, her running mate, has said it as well. They are the pro-censorship platform. But the interesting thing is there's also an admission on her part that these entities are controlled by the government, right? Now, the argument about why these tech agencies, why Twitter, why Facebook and YouTube are allowed to censor people for their political views that they don't like, is they say, well, this is a private company, right? They can just do whatever they want. It's a private company. Well, now we have the Twitter files showing that the FBI is colluding with them. So if the government is working with them, then at that point, the government has to respect all of our freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, right? The government can't be taking partisan stances. So if these platforms are indeed utilities rather than just services, they have to be available to everyone. You know, your power company is a utility. Your power company can't turn off your power because you're politically incorrect. You can be as racist and sexist and awful as you want, and your power company can't turn off your electricity because they're a public utility. They have a government monopoly, and because of that, they have to treat everyone equally. So if Facebook and Twitter and Google are being facilitated by the government, then they should respect all of our rights. And it's very clear, if you listen to Kamala Harris, that she admits that the government is facilitating these tech monopolies. So why are our freedoms not being protected, right? You know, in the public square, you have freedom of speech. You might not have freedom of speech at your job. Your boss might be able to fire you for disagreeing with you. But in the public square, unless you're breaking the law, you have the right to say what you want. And we're seeing that Twitter, Facebook, and Google are the public square. So our rights should be protected. But Kamala Harris continues to say, well, that these companies should be using their power to suppress certain views, that they have a responsibility to be crafting opinion in a certain way. That's exactly what a lot of the laws in the United States that were written about government propaganda were intended to oppose. You know, for a long time, Voice of America was forbidden from broadcasting in the United States because they didn't want to have a government propaganda apparatus. You know, Voice of America was broadcast around the world to spread the message of the United States, but it was explicitly illegal to broadcast it within the United States. Well, that law was gotten rid of under Barack Obama, and now it is legal for the American government to craft propaganda aimed at the American public. which they've always done to some degree or other with the intelligence agencies. We know about, you know, it was revealed that for a long time, the CIA had a program of manipulating the media. And there's a lot that's been revealed about that. But it is now completely legal for the American government to do that. And Kamala Harris's position is she wants Twitter and Facebook to not only craft public opinion in one certain way, but also to suppress certain messages that she disagrees with. She thinks that Donald Trump shouldn't be allowed on social media. She thinks that certain views shouldn't be out there. All of this points toward a more totalitarian apparatus. And it's funny because that's what we're told to be afraid of with Donald Trump. But she's doing it, right? Everything that she's warning us Trump might do, which he didn't do when he was in office, you know, for 4 years, is things that she is already doing. So I think we should be concerned about that.
You mentioned Google and Facebook, the big tech companies, several times. But, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has basically written a letter coming out saying that he kind of regrets the censorship during COVID and whatnot. But at the same time, we just had Google lose a lawsuit saying that they're a monopoly. Facebook's currently in a lawsuit by the government saying that they're a monopoly. So I don't necessarily know how much I would trust Zuckerberg saying that he cares so much about the censorship as he's just trying to rebrand himself so he doesn't lose this lawsuit with the government saying that they're a monopoly just like Google did. What do you think about the Zuckerberg letter?
Well, I think that in a lot of ways, you know, the Twitter files and now the Zuckerberg letter, the tech monopolies realize that everyone knows that speech is being controlled and crafted in certain ways. And it's the whole thing about it's better to hear it from you if you've done something wrong than to hear it from somebody else. And they would like to frame the conversation around what's already apparent, which is that there's huge amounts of censorship online and manipulation of algorithms to serve political ends. They want to get ahead of that and control the conversation around it. So Mark Zuckerberg apologizing for it, Elon Musk making the emails public, all of that indicates that's just an effort to get ahead of this. One thing I will also point out is that, you know, for a while, you know, the printing press was brought to Europe. And when it was in Europe, the Gutenberg Bible, it originally was developed in Asia on the Korean Peninsula and in China and elsewhere. But then eventually, when it got to Europe, it was at first owned only by the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church used it to print their Bibles and print their indulgences. And this new technology, the printing press, they had a control of it. But it was only a matter of time before critics of the Catholic Church got their hands on printing presses and started printing pamphlets and started printing the Bible translated into their own languages. And that when you have a new piece of information technology, for a while, it'll be dominated by the powers that be. But pretty soon, other forces get their hands on it. And that is what is happening with social media. Russia's got Yandex. TikTok is an outlet that they say it's controlled by China. It's not controlled by China, but it's just not under the domination of the tech monopolies. It's not part of the Silicon Valley Club, and they're very threatened by it. And that the idea that all the social media giants will be these huge monopolies controlled by the American government, and there'll be no alternatives out there, that's an illusion, right? And that the monopoly of the U.S. government-created tech monopolies is going to go away. Other forces around the world are going to have social media outlets and spread their views. And what Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk and others are trying to slow down the process of that happening, right? If Twitter and Facebook tighten their grip too much, people are just going to go elsewhere. And there'll be other services and other outlets they can go to, and they'll lose their monopoly. So Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, they need to slow down the process of people abandoning the tech monopolies. They need to slow down the process of people just going to other and alternative sources of information just popping up. And they're trying to slow down this process. But in Congress, a lot of the Democrats especially are not really concerned about that. They just want tech censorship right now for short-term political gain. And Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg are thinking about the long-term interest of their company. And how if they, you know, I mean, if Facebook were to say, oh, okay, you know, we're going to ban all Trump supporters from Facebook, there would be a new Facebook that would start up immediately that would be controlled by Trumpers, and they'd all be on there, and Facebook would lose all of that business and lose all of the ability to influence them. They'd much more rather have Trump supporters on Facebook being kind of nudged the way Facebook wants. And that's kind of the division. You know, Truth Social is this outlet Trump invented, you know, as a way, as an alternative to the tech monopolies, and that Elon Musk got control of Twitter and he's tried to move it in a different direction. And that, yeah, those who control the tech monopolies have a huge amount of power, no question about it. And it's only a matter of time before there's alternatives out there and there's real competition with them. And they're trying to slow down the process.
In your book, Kamala Harris and the Future of America, the vast majority of the book focuses on Kamala, but towards the end, you basically talk about Trump, and then you're very critical of Trump as well. So it's not like you're writing this book and you're, you know, praising Trump and bashing Harris. You're actually kind of bashing them both. And like I mentioned before, your book came out in 2020, so you almost had the entire Trump presidency of information to go on. I guess the question is, I guess at this point, is like, we have this election, right? We have Trump and we have Harris. Who is the lesser of, I mean, is that ultimately the thing? Who's the lesser of two evils in 2024? Is that what we're essentially getting at right now?
Well, I think Trump is clearly the lesser of two evils. And that, you know, I was very, very critical of Trump in that book. And I have softened on Trump a little bit. What Trump did on the Korean Peninsula, meeting with Kim Jong-un, that was a great step forward. And the people who pushed Trump to do the worst things that he did are all against him now. And that's what Kamala Harris was talking about at the debate. John Bolton, the national security advisor who pushed him to attack Venezuela and carry out a coup there, is now against him. Mark Milley, the Pentagon brass, he's against him. Mark Esper is against him. You know, Dick Cheney is against Donald Trump. I mean, it seems like, you know, all the people that were originally in the Trump camp and were pushing the bad things Trump did have betrayed Trump. Mike Pompeo turned against Donald Trump and supported the prosecution of him. Trump is at this point, you know, being supported by the people that were better. And I will say there was a great moment after Trump left office, the Quantum Leap speech. I loved that. That was a beautiful speech. I agreed with pretty much everything he said in the speech about building new cities and raising the population, giving, you know, incentives to families to have more children, building highways and all of that. And at the end of my book, I talked about Roosevelt. I talked about Abraham Lincoln. I talked about Huey Long, the governor of Louisiana, as kind of the ideal of what, you know, a kind of populist leader we could have in our time. And you know, Trump, I don't agree with everything. There's a lot he says I don't agree with. But he, you know, there was that quantum leap moment that he gave. I mean, go look up the Trump quantum leap speech. It was amazing. And I feel like if he's going to actually, if he wins, if for him to stay in office, he's going to need a lot of Americans to have his back because the establishment will be against him. And that's why I find it very inspiring. I was at the Libertarian Party's convention in the spring, and he spoke at it. And he said that if he wins, he will appoint a Libertarian Party member to his cabinet. And I think, you know, he was there because he needs activists. He needs people that will support him. And so he's, you know, and the fact that he's embraced RFK and he's embraced Tulsi Gabbard, you know, those are both anti-war voices. And, you know, RFK in particular is anti-vaccine, critical of the medical establishment and the lockdowns and such. And the fact that he's embraced both of them shows that he's leaning in more to the anti-war and populist message. So I think Trump could be swayed and pushed by circumstances to move in a very good direction. And I think that if he gets back into office, he is going to be on the defensive. And that if he wants to stay strong and if he wants to accomplish a lot of things as president, he's going to have to move in a good direction. But maybe not. We don't really know. And there's a good chance Trump could win and do a lot of bad things also, right? I don't agree with a lot of what he says about China. There's plenty of things I'm critical of Donald Trump on. But I will say that Trump can be moved, whereas I think Kamala Harris is completely plastic. She's just a completely plastic synthetic creation. She's somebody they know how to push her buttons, and some very powerful interests that have a very sinister agenda have worked on her for years and know exactly how to control her. Whereas Donald Trump, people talk about Donald Trump's ego. Donald Trump is so egotistical. That's great. That's the best thing he's got going for him, because he doesn't want to be remembered by history as the guy who started World War III. He's more concerned with how history remembers him than doing what the deep state people around him might want him to do. And the fact that Donald Trump has an ego, the fact that Donald Trump is concerned about his image and such, the fact that, you know, that is a good thing, because we should want a president who wants to do the right thing and wants to be remembered as a good guy. We should want that in a leader. And I think Kamala Harris is more concerned about just kind of pushing the buttons. And, you know, she's colored inside the lines her whole life and done all the right things, slept with the right people, et cetera, to get where she is. And then she's got a lot of rage. And the only time that Kamala Harris is really being herself and really letting her emotions come out is when she's harming other people. She has a huge amount of rage, pent up anger and a desire for vengeance, a desire to harm other people. And so she's just kind of a robot most of the time. And then that vengeance, that sadism, that cruelty that we saw as a prosecutor, that we see elsewhere, that comes out every so often. So I think that we're much better off with a Trump presidency than a Kamala Harris presidency, despite, you know, a lot of things about Trump that are, you know, difficult and could be bad. I think that Trump is a much better option than Kamala Harris at this point.
So, Caleb, we just had the 2024 debate between Trump and Harris. They're saying it's going to be possibly the only debate. A lot of people are saying that Trump lost the debate. Other people are saying that Trump won the debate. I mean, I watched the debate. You watched the debate. ABC was quite biased, not just in terms of moderating, but the way that they actually asked the questions, the way, you know, they fact-checked Trump. They never fact-checked Kamala Harris. Just the way that they phrased the questions and just the questions in general. I mean, a lot of the questions I remember is talking about January 6th, talking about, you know, what happened with you basically being an election denier. So nothing that really had to do with the actual policy debates. And then Kamala Harris kept mentioning Project 2025. Trump said many times, like, I have no association with this Project 20. Of course, that was never fact-checked. Then later on, I think CNN did, I saw it tweeted out, but it was something like Trump had 38 lies, Kamala Harris had one. But it's like, well, I mean, that's complete farce, right? I mean, like... Yeah. And like you said, this is coming from a person that basically in this book, you did not support Trump at all. I want to make this clear. Like, this is not coming from like a Trump supporter.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it was, I think that Trump actually did very well in the debate, given the circumstances. It was a 3-on-1 fight, and he still managed to score some pretty big punches. They did not ever correct anything that Kamala Harris said. They gave a half hour on abortion, which is an issue that, you know, that public opinion. I mean, Trump, as someone who believes abortion should be up to the states and the states should have the right to ban abortion, he's in the minority on that, right? I mean, it's you know, there's a pretty solid pro-choice minority, and they spent a half hour just talking about that. Kamala Harris was able to accuse Trump of taking positions he doesn't take. He's not for a federal abortion ban. But the fact that they gave Kamala Harris, potentially the first woman president of the United States, 30 minutes to talk about abortion, I mean, that was clearly set up to be in her favor. But Trump, he made some points that are really important. One point that when he said we're a nation in decline, people in their bones know that. I mean, people in their bones know this, right? The public overwhelmingly can see that our infrastructure is falling apart. Living standards are dropping. And Donald Trump is right on that point. And that Bidenomics is not working. And Kamala Harris has been presiding over Bidenomics. And there were moments where he said, why don't you do this? Why don't you just do it? But you're in office right now. If you're going to do all these things, why don't you just do them? There were moments where Trump was really coming out strong. And, you know, also Kamala Harris, I mean, the hand gestures looked completely fake. It was so silly. At one point when Trump mentioned Kamala Harris's father, she started going, yeah. I mean, it was just so completely contrived, the hand gestures. It was so fake. You know, and that Kamala Harris came off as very plastic. And the way the media is just in overdrive saying, oh, she won, she did so well. It's like, did I watch the same debate as you? You know, and they want to focus on people eating pets, and they want to focus on, oh, Kamala Harris did so well. But if you actually look at it, a lot of polls are showing that voters don't think Trump got completely demolished. I don't think Trump got completely demolished. I don't think Kamala Harris looked particularly good. And that people can also see, even people who might think that Trump didn't do so well, they can still see it was rigged against him. And that's the point, because Americans are against the establishment. And the establishment was very clearly on one side of that debate. The deck was stacked against Donald Trump. And we Americans, we like the underdog. And Donald Trump came across as the underdog in that debate very clearly.
Trump mentioned in Ohio talking about immigrants stealing the pets and eating them. And then right after, David, one of the, you know, quote unquote moderators, is like, well, we actually just called the city manager, and he says that's not true. And I'm thinking, okay, like, I in real time, first off, I mean, do you just happen to have the city manager on standby? I mean, and then you happen to have this entire conversation. It had to have been like 20 seconds later. And I'm just like, how is that even possible? And then secondly, how is the city manager an authority? If this did actually happen, you think the first call you make is to the city manager, like, hey, by the way, my pet Bubba just happened to get kidnapped. And then I saw them down the street roasting him. And then he's talking about one of the other comments he made where Trump was like, well, that was sarcasm. Then he's like, well, I didn't read it that way. I mean, again, maybe it wasn't sarcasm. Maybe the moderator's right. But the fact is, who are you to, you're talking to the actual source. Isn't Trump in this case the primary source? And then you're like, well, actually, I mean, you're essentially saying, I don't believe you. Again, you're the moderator. You might not believe him, but he is the primary source.
Yeah, I mean, I find that the media focusing on that and making that the focus is such a way to avoid the topic. I mean, there were a couple moments in the debate that were just displays of political ignorance. It was Americans just don't know what's going on. A lot of people are just not well-versed in foreign policy. One thing Kamala Harris said is she said, well, Donald Trump was making computer chips and selling them to China so that they could enhance their military. Well, I follow the computer chip issue. Right. As my job as a reporter for RT, I've covered that issue many times. The United States has worked very hard to prevent China from making their own chips. That's the issue. Right. Is we don't want China to be able to make their own computer chips. We want them to keep buying it from the United States. And Republicans in Congress have passed laws to try and outlaw factories in China that are just to make computer chips just for China. Like it's, you know, the selling computer chips to China is what the goal of anti-China folks have want. They don't want China to have the capacity to make its own chips by itself. So that was just a complete distortion of the debate. The other thing was Donald Trump said that he had blocked the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and that when Biden got into office, he made the Nord Stream 2 pipeline happen. Well, we all know that Joe Biden blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So if you want to get points for being against the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, I mean, Biden's won that one. He blew it up. Now, I think that was an act of terrorism, right? If you blow up a pipeline, right, that's an act of terrorism. It was an environmental disaster, but I mean, Biden did it. So, I mean, it's like if Donald Trump wants points for being against the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, I think Biden's won that one. But again, Americans don't know that. People don't know that Biden blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is very obvious to the rest of the world. So, you know, I watched that and I just was kind of disappointed with the terms of discourse. People don't know. At some points, Kamala was trying to outdo Trump on being anti-China. She mentioned the fentanyl issue, which is very important to a lot of Trump supporters. I will say that there were also a lot of online references in the debate. At one point, when Kamala Harris interrupted Trump, he said, oh, I'm speaking now. And that was a reference to the video of Kamala Harris being confronted by the protesters and saying that. And the thing about, you know, the cats and dogs and all that, that's been going around Trump or social media, you know, and that there was, and that's just something that all politicians are going to have to deal with is because of social media, we all kind of have our social media bubble. And so there's going to be less common points of reference, right? You know, and so you have to speak to a lot of different people in a lot of different areas who are seeing a lot of different things, right? It's not like it used to be decades ago where we were all watching the same TV shows, all reading the same newspapers. It's not like that anymore. There's a lot more diversity and people have much more of their own bubbles. So you have to be able to speak to people who may be seeing very, very different information than you.
I thought one of the interesting parts of the debate is where Kamala Harris was talking about Trump inheriting this $400 million from his daddy, essentially intimating that he comes from the elites and whatnot. But since Kamala Harris has never won a primary, right? She's basically been thrust into the Democratic nominee position. And then since it's been announced that she now is running for the Democratic Party, she's raised over $500 million, over $500 million. Essentially, what she's trying to say is that, hey, Trump is representing wealth, when in fact, like, she's representing significantly more wealth than Trump's representing. Isn't that really what she's getting at? Like, oh, he comes from the elites, he's representing them, when she, in fact, is representing the quote-unquote elites, and she's raised over $500 million in a couple months.
I'll say a couple things to that. First of all, Donald Trump makes no bones about the fact that he comes from money. His father was a real estate giant in New York City. I mean, everyone knows that. Kamala Harris has tried to run this game about she grew up middle class, she grew up poor, and that is such a joke. I mean, her father, Donald Harris, is descended from the wealthiest plantation owners in Jamaica. He brags about this. He studied at Stanford University. He was an advisor to the prime ministers of Jamaica, an economic advisor to Michael Manley, among others. Her mother is from a family in India that was so wealthy that they could send their daughter, not their son, but their daughter to study in the United States, right? In a traditional Indian family, the male children are going to get priority. And sending your son or daughter to study in the United States, especially back in the early 1960s, is not a cheap thing to do. But her family was so wealthy that they could send their daughter all the way to the United States to go to medical school. Like, she doesn't come from poverty. Like, give me a break, okay? The other thing is that Donald Trump does have his own money, right? And that, in a way, makes Donald Trump independent. Donald Trump is not going to go broke if he's out of a job. Whereas Kamala Harris has gone through all the vehicles, all the elite schools and the political machine in California. She's been vetted to be a functionary of the people who do have money. Whereas Donald Trump just has his own money, right? And so Donald Trump is more independent, I think, of the forces and wealth and power that dominate the world. Whereas Kamala Harris is someone who's been groomed to be a functionary of wealth and power. And it's a little bit different. But she didn't grow up poor by any means. But she's much more of a functionary. Whereas Donald Trump is a more independent actor. He's a freewheeling, wealthy real estate owner himself. And he's gotten into politics. And that, you know, he's gotten into politics for his own reasons. And that makes him more independent and capable of doing better things, I think.
Caleb, one of the more intriguing quotes from your book, you know, try to highlight a few that I find interesting, but I'll just read the quote. While spy movies feature the CIA as engaging in James Bond-like action adventures, one of the primary activities of the U.S. intelligence apparatus is controlling and crafting U.S. culture, end of your quote. What is the cultural narrative that the CIA in 2024 is currently creating?
Well, that's interesting. And the sources on this, go look at Project Mockingbird, go look at the history of the Congress for Cultural Freedom program. A lot of what the intelligence agencies do is they craft the culture and craft the narrative. I think that at this point, the CIA is largely trying to present the image of a United States that is not threatening. Right? That they're trying to present the image of America, you know, yeah, slavery happened and all that, but look, we're getting over it. Look how woke we are. Look how apologetic we are about it. And we just want to spread human rights and freedom around the world. We want to empower LGBT people and women, and we're not scary and we're not authoritarian and we're sorry about all the bad things in our history. That's all in the past. And you got to be scared of those Russians and those Chinese and those Cubans and those Iranians because they're authoritarian and scary. And we're not that anymore. And in fact, we're such an open, free society that's just so tolerant and just so, you know, emasculated that we actually are. We show people what it's like to be this nice, caring, tolerant, touchy-feely, you know, society. And it's a really sinister image because we know that beneath that, you know, benign image, very awful things are happening. We have a very authoritarian government that is killing people with drones, that is entrapping people. The U.S. state is quite vicious when it really gets down to it. But the image is they want to present us as this nice, benign, apologetic, sensitive, woke country while we march toward World War III, while we're arming neo-Nazis in Ukraine, while we're, you know, unleashing al-Qaeda-like terrorist groups across the Middle East to destabilize countries and all of that. I think that the Biden presidency is a lot like the Jimmy Carter presidency. You know, Jimmy Carter was this nice old man, just the nice old man, and oh, he called himself the peace president. And that's one of the lies Kamala Harris told in her speech. She said that there's not any American soldiers anywhere in active combat zones. That's a lie. In Syria, they're in Syria without the permission of the Syrian government, and they fought with Iraqi militias. They're in Iraq, and they fought with Iranian-backed militias. There are American soldiers in combat zones. There's three U.S. Navy personnel that went missing in the Gulf, in the Red Sea recently, and that most likely was because of the Houthis. We don't know. The U.S. doesn't want to say that for certain reasons, probably because it'll make it harder to negotiate with the Houthis in the future. But yeah, there are U.S. military personnel in combat zones. But the main thing is kind of like during the Carter presidency, he's called himself the peace president. He started the war in Afghanistan and he found Osama bin Laden and sent him to Afghanistan to wage a big, long, ugly proxy war with the Soviet Union. He started the Contra War in Nicaragua. The people of Nicaragua had a revolution, and then the USA started arming drug cartels and drug dealers to go down there in Nicaragua and wage an ugly civil war that went on for a decade. And that Jimmy Carter was this accommodating, soft, nice guy president, when in reality, the USA was escalating its tensions around the world. And that the other thing about Jimmy Carter was that he basically took actions that resulted in oil scarcity and making the gas prices very high. Right? That was what people remember his presidency for. And he created kind of an energy crisis in which the oil companies made a huge amount of money because supply and demand, the less oil on the market, the more money. And then he brought in Paul Volcker to, you know, overturn the financial regulations and deregulate lending in a way that was just absolutely crazy. And if you read, you know, what the the Carter administration was advocating, the Global 2000 report, they wanted the United States to help decrease the global population, decrease consumption, and drive down living standards. And they were doing it in the name of kind of social justice, woke politics. But really, their message was America needs to be poorer, and we need to foment chaos around the world to defeat our geopolitical rivals. That's what Joe Biden has been doing, and that's what Kamala Harris believes. And that's what that CIA regime change color revolution apparatus has always been pushing, right? They want the United States to appear really, really nice and soft, and they want to kind of emasculate the culture and calm things down while they reduce living standards in the United States, while they create chaos and regime change wars around the world to weaken countries. That's what they want to do. Whereas the Reagan Revolution was largely the military kind of pushing back against Carter, and it was peace through strength, let's make America great again. They want the United States to come across as a strong country, and that there is a division among the rich at this point. You have the ultra rich, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the DuPonts, the big monopolies, and they very much want to secure their monopoly long term. And they want to do that with degrowth and reducing consumption and driving down living standards, reducing the population. Whereas I think most rich people just want to make money, right? Most of the wealthy people, they just want to make money. And in order to do that, they want a stronger economy. They want economic growth. And that means they're going to have paved roads. And that means they're going to have, you know, power plants and nuclear energy to you know, have energy and to make the economy stronger. And that they believe in economic growth so they can make money, whereas the ultra-rich are trying to kind of lock down society and dramatically reduce consumption in order to stay in power. And that division, Carl Oglesby wrote a great book called The Yankee and Cowboy War, which I quote in my book on Kamala Harris. There's also a great book by Carol Quigley, who was the mentor of Bill Clinton, the political science professor and others. He wrote Tragedy and Hope, and he wrote The Anglo-American Establishment, talking about the kind of the old money of New England and their kind of degrowth agenda. Lyndon LaRouche spent his life writing about this. He wrote There Is No Limit to Growth. He wrote The Ugly Truth about Milton Friedman. And he wrote a lot of books from this perspective, talking about the influence of the London elite and the Anglo elite in the United States. And I think you can really divide the American ruling class into these two camps, between the Yankees and the Cowboys, or the New England establishment, the Eastern establishment, the old money, and the bulk of the rich.
If you were to update that book, I would imagine the globalists have to be like the WF and just kind of...
They are the globalists. The World Economic Forum and the Council on Foreign Relations. And I mean, this is all descended from the Round Table Group that was created. So Cecil Rhodes was the big British banker, colonizer of Africa, Rhodesia. You know, Zimbabwe used to be called Rhodesia. It was named after him. And his estate, when he died, he set money aside for the creation of, he called it a secret society to advance the aims of the British Empire. What they ultimately created was a think tank called the Round Table Group that was headed by Lord Milner. And they created the New York Council on Foreign Relations, which is now just the Council on Foreign Relations. And there's the Asia Society that was paid for by the Rockefellers. The World Economic Forum comes out of these circles. And it's just, these are the ultra-rich that have kind of a more managerial long-term vision. Silicon Valley is an outgrowth of this wing of American capital, I may add, right? That, you know, they largely created Silicon Valley. The market was not going to kind of facilitate that, but they made a strategic decision. Zbigniew Brzezinski, he published a book called The Technotronic Era, arguing that control of technology could be a way that the United States could dominate and, quote, Americanize the world. And he published that book in the early 70s. And in the late 70s, we saw the intelligence apparatus pivoting toward, you know, funding and setting up computer companies. And that, you know, I always talk about Al Gore, because Al Gore, he was quoted or misquoted as saying, "I invented the Internet." And what he was referring to was the fact that he, as a member of Congress and as vice president, worked really, really hard to secure government contracts and funding for the Silicon Valley tech monopolies. That's very interesting, because Al Gore's personal spiritual advisor, who came to the White House many times under the Clinton administration, who met with him and Tipper many times, was this weird occult mystic guru named Marilyn Ferguson. And Marilyn Ferguson was out of the Stanford Research Institute in California, and she published this book called The Aquarian Conspiracy. And in that book, she says there's a global movement arising around the world. It's not pro-communist or anti-communist. It's just about human awakening. And there's going to be a huge global explosion to bring the world back into balance with nature. And we're going to drive down the population and we're going to, you know, bring the world back into balance, and powerful institutions are going to fall and the world's just going to be reorganized. Everything's going to be in balance. And she calls it the Aquarian conspiracy. And this is the woman who was talking to Al Gore. And she says in that book that the Stanford Research Institute is the center of her Aquarian conspiracy. She says, America is free, but California is freer. It's the center of this global consciousness movement that she's creating. And it was the Stanford Research Institute was where a lot of that computer research, when we talk about Silicon Valley, we're talking about Northern California, we're talking about the Stanford Research Institute. This is the personal spiritual advisor of Al Gore, who's credited with inventing the internet. This is the view of the tech monopolists and the tech elites, right? And that they want to reduce the population, they want to reduce consumption and bring everything back into balance with some kind of global explosion that they're creating. It's kind of frightening. And that's the view of that, you know, World Economic Forum, that Eastern establishment. You know, that is the managerial ultra rich. That is what they want to do. And I think the bulk of humanity wants to resist it because the nature of humanity is growth. We always want more than we already have. Human beings are tool-making creatures. And in just a few thousand years, we've gone from hunter-gatherers in the woods to space travel and iPhones. Human beings believe in progress and expansion. So they're trying to combat the very nature of humanity.
What is it, 56 days till the election? How do you see this shaking up?
I feel like there's going to be a lot of provocations. And we're urging people to be very careful because it looks like there will be a lot of attempts by both sides to accuse the other side of being extreme. You know, January 6th was a setup, and I would urge people to be very, very careful. You know, Charlottesville was also kind of a setup in a way, if you look at what actually happened. You know, the neo-Nazi kind of people have been having protests for a long time, but this one got a huge amount of attention, went viral, and there was no police presence to keep the two crowds away from each other. And I would just urge people to be very, very cautious, because I feel like Kamala Harris needs to create a narrative that Donald Trump is just so dangerous and authoritarian that if he gets in, you know, we're all going to die, so we have to vote for her. And I would urge people to be very, very careful. I feel like there will be a lot of turbulence in the next few weeks that, you know, everything is going to be done to try and sway the vote one way or another with very dramatic media event. I think Trump will win if it's a fair election. I think that he has the votes in the key places. He needs to get them, you know, the Rust Belt states, the red states, the Electoral College. I think Trump will win. And also, I think Muslims in key states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, there's a lot of Muslims there. They're not going to go out and vote for Kamala Harris after what's going on in Gaza and the Palestine thing. So I think Trump will win, but I think there will be a lot of drama in the coming weeks to confuse and sway people one way or another. We recently saw a horrendous riot in Britain that was very much staged by social media, right? A tweet went viral with false information about a horrendous murder that had happened, and all kinds of people were assembled in one place. And there was a lot of ugly things that were happened, but social media really made it happen. And that was used to then crack down on everyone's free speech and right to protest. And I worry about things like that. So I would urge people to be very careful in the coming weeks of any provocations you might see on social media, because I feel like there is a desperation to kind of solidly nail this down for Kamala Harris on the part of the tech monopolies and the elites. And I hope they're not able to do that.
After Kamala Harris was the presidential nominee, her book disappeared off of Amazon. But I was looking at it today. You still don't actually have the Kindle version. So did you ever have a Kindle version, or did you? It was
Yeah, if you go to Gumroad, I've been selling them the PDF on Gumroad, on the website Gumroad. So first, after Amazon took it down, I put it on Lulu. And then Lulu stopped processing transactions for it, which was very odd. And so then I put it on Gumroad, and you can buy the PDF on the Gumroad. If you go to my website, CalebMaupin.net, you click on the Kamala Harris book, it takes you to Gumroad.com, and you can buy a PDF of the book on Gumroad. And then Amazon restored it 7 days later. Lulu has, you know, begun processing transactions. You can buy it on Lulu now. So it's pretty widely available. So yeah, if you want a PDF, just check it out on Gumroad.com, or just go to my website, CalebMaupin.net, and you can click the link and you can buy the PDF.
I guess my question was, prior to the ban, did you actually offer the ebook though on
No,
Amazon?
I don't. Okay. I have avoided doing ebooks because there's a lot of smear artists who've been, you know, who have targeted me. I mean, you've seen I've been canceled and stuff. And one thing that they do is they go through my books and they quote mine them. right? They find a quote. And so I've generally tried to sell physical copies of my books rather than electronic ones, because I don't want people to go through my books and find a quote that they can then use to say, because if you watch the hate videos about me, they always say, you know, they'll have a totally benign thing that I'll say, and they'll say, and by that he means kill all the Jews or something like that. Yeah, you know, and so I want to make it harder for people to, you know, get an electronic copy of my book and just go through it and find quotes that they can use against me. So I generally sell physical copies of my books, not ebooks.
Yeah, it seems like you've had a lot of various attacks. I was listening to a podcast and you were saying that all social media is fake. As someone that's actually like gone through this kind of rigmarole, what's your take on that?
Well, the main thing is to stay in the real world and try to just not get caught up in social media, because it is very fake. The other thing I would encourage people to do is, you don't know the whole story, right? And I've noticed that the way the world seems to work is that everyone knows about one sentence about everything, right? And, you know, I got a huge amount of attention after my book was banned, because the one sentence everybody knew was, hey, Caleb wrote a book about Kamala Harris and they banned it from Amazon. Well, that was a good sentence where I got a lot of attention and my social media was soaring. But for a while, and a number of times, there's been one bad sentence going around about me. And there's a lot more to it than that. And that's one of the problems with social media, is everyone hears one thing and they think, well, they have to comment on it, right? Well, you don't know what happened. You don't know the details. And that if you don't know the details, you know, don't comment on it. That's my advice. And I see stuff floating around. This person said this, this person said that. Well, if you really feel a need to comment on it, do so. But for the most part, if all you know is one sentence, right, be careful, because you don't really know what you're doing. And in a lot of cases, and a lot of people don't realize this, you know, when someone's being targeted, you might disagree with the person, but you may not agree with the main smear. I've had a lot of people who, you know, disagree with me about this or that, but they can see that the main things that have gone out are not true. And so you got to be careful with that, because if someone's being targeted with a really big lie and you go up and you say, oh, well, I just don't agree with them, you're kind of feeding into the ganging up and denounce on the person. So I urge people to think about, you know, the main thing is you have to think about the bigger picture, right? You know, we all are very focused on our own individual niche and the people that we're arguing with today on the internet. But you want to really try to think about the bigger picture. Social media makes everything very, very individual. You want to think about the bigger picture and how things are framed. And that's my advice. And also, you know, Center for Political Innovation, we're building a community of people that are just doing stuff in real life and trying to change the world. And that's where my focus is building a real network of people that can do real things to build a real anti-imperialist community.
Caleb Maupin is today's guest. He's the author of the book Kamala Harris and the Future of America, an essay in three parts. So, Caleb, thank you for joining us today. Just two final questions. Where can people get a hold of you, find your books, whatever information you want to provide? And then secondly, just leave us with a final thought related to the book or anything that is on your mind.
Okay, well, you can find my stuff. I'm at CalebMaupin.net, CalebMaupin.net. I'm also, my organization is called the Center for Political Innovation, CPIUSA.org. We're an organization that has been doing great things, the Center for Political Innovation. And my final thought is that creativity is the best thing you have. Your creativity is something that is really, really special and should be nurtured. And I would encourage people to find their creative mind and really nurture it and celebrate it. And don't let it be suppressed by our depressing low-wage economy where people's creativity is suppressed. Your creativity is the most beautiful thing you have. Nurture it and let it grow.
My dear friends, that is it for this episode of El Podcast. Once again, if you're not yet subscribed, please subscribe on YouTube as well as Rumble. You can also find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. We thank you all from the bottom of our hearts for watching and listening, and we will see you on the next episode.